The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stenson for Kate Archer Kent. When your employer says, no political speech at work, do you know exactly what that means? What if you work for a school? Where do you draw the line between supporting kids and talking about current events and getting political? Last December, a kindergarten teacher at a Waukesha elementary school was told to take down a rainbow flag she had on display in her classroom. And when she refused, she was suspended for a day. The flag was gone when she returned. This is just one of the flashpoints after the Waukesha School District sent a letter to its staff telling them to remove divisive symbols. Now the ACLU of Wisconsin is warning the Waukesha School District that their policy may run afoul of the law. You can join in on our conversation this morning. Teachers, we'd love to hear from you. How do you navigate these issues at school? We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us ideas@WPR.org. To learn more, we're speaking with Christine Donahoe, staff attorney for the ACLU of Wisconsin. Chris, welcome to the morning show. Chris, are you with us?
I'm sorry, I was on mute, which is, just embarrassing after 2 years of this. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Zoom problems. We all have them, right? Mm-hmm. So I want to hear from you. What is the ACLU's concern about the Waukesha School District policy?
Well, we have several concerns. Based on what we've heard, this policy could be violating several laws, including the First Amendment, the Due Process Clause, and various anti-discrimination laws like the Equal Access Act and Title IX. So we have submitted a letter requesting more information and records to determine exactly what's going on and try to figure out exactly what laws could be implicated here.
And so what are your First Amendment concerns with the policy?
Sure. Well, there's a couple different things. We've heard reports that various student locker signs have been taken down and students have free speech rights at school. They're not the same as an adult would have on a public sidewalk, but students don't shed all their free speech in a school. And so we want to ensure that they're able to express themselves to the extent that they can. And students also have the right to learn and receive information and knowledge and share ideas. And it's critical to protect both students and educators' right to talk in the classroom, even about those opinions that might evoke strong emotions, such as race and gender. So we want to be sure that no one's free speech rights are being stifled simply to try to sanitize the classroom.
And so how should administrators approach the issue in your mind? I mean, given that they do have some ability, right, to kind of restrict the time, place, and manner of speech in their buildings, what do you think they should be doing?
Sure. So student administrators' job is to make sure that speech doesn't cause a substantial disruption and it's not interfering with any student's ability to learn and be in the classroom. But administrators also have a duty to ensure that the classrooms and schools are free from discrimination, bullying, and harassment, and that students are learning and able to share ideas. So if administrators are going to have a policy to try to restrict various types of speech, it has to be one, specific enough so that everybody understands the policy very well and educators can follow it and know exactly what the policy is. And two, that that it doesn't, I'm sorry, I just lost my thread, but yeah. It needs to be specific and it needs to be, it needs to make sure that it doesn't violate any students' rights in expressing themselves. Well, and that it doesn't have a chilling effect on the classroom.
Yes. And talk to me about how students' rights and staff and teacher rights differ here. I mean, are they afforded the same rights?
It is different. The teachers in this case are public employees. They're employees of the school district. And so the administrators can restrict to some extent what's being said and taught and displayed in the classroom. What I was going to say earlier was that the policy has to be applied equitably and non-discriminatorily. So one concern based on the reports we've heard is that this policy that restricts quote unquote political or controversial signage is not being applied consistently. And what we've heard and what the concern is that the school district is actually essentially restricting one type of viewpoint, and they're taking down LGBTQ supportive messages, Black Lives Matter supportive messages, but they're not applying the policy equally on what would be considered more conservative leaning messages. And that is considered viewpoint discrimination, and that runs afoul of the First Amendment. So one, the policy needs to be specific enough that it gives everyone notice of what it is. And two, it has to be applied consistently. And our concern is that it's not being.
And so when you say it has to be specific enough, what would that look like? I mean, it does in the letter that was sent out to staff. I mean, there are particular political slogans named, right? Like Black Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter, right? Like they're calling out specific terms.
They are, but they're also claiming that that list is not exhaustive. So these are just examples of messages that would be considered political or controversial, but there is, a bunch of other types of messages that could also be considered political. And based on the records that we've seen communication, emails, other letters from the school district and among principals and teachers. Based on all of that communication, it seems like there is a lot of confusion, and especially there was at the beginning, as to how far this policy reaches. So for example, I saw communication where one principal would say, okay, safe space signs are still okay. But then the next day or a few days later, there was an email saying, okay, we just heard back and actually those signs aren't okay. So, there is confusion there. We've also heard reports that in at least one case, the school's own non-discrimination policy had to be taken down. So I think that, there's a lot of questions and concerns around why the school's own policy would be considered political or controversial. So in practice, what we're seeing is a lot of confusion to the extent that teachers really aren't given the notice that they need so that they can comply. And I just want to mention briefly one case out of Minnesota that went to the U.S. Supreme Court was a case where Minnesota was trying to ban political apparel at voting places. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, well, the word political is so vague and so broad that even the word vote could be considered a political message. Mm. And that ban was struck down.
Mm. So the school that was under the understanding that they could not display their own non-discrimination policy, what school was that?
I'm not sure of the I don't have that right in front of me.
Okay.
And I only heard of one instance. And again, the reason that we submitted this records request is because we want to see what records the school district has. We're at the stage right now where we're hearing from many different community members, various incidents like this, but we need to confirm with the school district exactly what's going on.
Okay. Okay. But it's your understanding that one of the issues here is that this is being applied differently independently by different schools in the Waukesha School District.
It's the concern is more that the inconsistency applies to what viewpoint's being expressed.
Mm-hmm.
And so the school does not have the right to suppress one viewpoint and allow another on a subject. And the school district is claiming, oh, this applies to anything that's political or controversial. But the reports that we're hearing is that really it's only one type of message that's being taken down. And those are messages in support of marginalized communities like Black communities and LGBTQ communities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We're talking about schools and free speech with Chris Donahoe, staff attorney for the ACLU of Wisconsin. I'm Molly Stentz. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. We're speaking with Chris Donahoe, staff attorney for the ACLU of Wisconsin. They've suggested the Waukesha School District's policy banning political signs is being enforced only against certain viewpoints. Are you in the Waukesha School District? Would love to hear from you this morning. Has there been conflict over politics at your school? Join us. We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email, ideas at WPR.org. Well, Chris, I imagine as an administrator, you are dealing with parents who may be saying, we're not ready, and maybe even at the elementary school level, like, we're not ready to go there with our children. We're not ready to have these discussions about complex political issues. Maybe parents are seeing them as distracting from academics. What do you say to them?
Well, again, if the school believes that there is a substantial interference with students' ability to learn, then they can act. But I don't believe that that's what's being alleged here by the school district. I think what they're trying to do, or I should say what they're claiming that they're doing, is somehow trying to turn the temperature down on political divisiveness. I imagine, and again, we don't have all the records from the school district, but I imagine that this is really not an issue at the elementary school level. But this is more about high schoolers. We've heard reports of students who are part of the Gay Straight Alliance having their locker signs ripped down, but the school's allowing the football club to have their locker signs up, and Students for Life to allow a lobby sign to be in the lobby. So again, this is an issue of what ideas are the school district allowing to be present and what ideas are they suppressing? And you know, the school district needs to apply whatever policy it is consistently. They have more control over what is displayed and expressed in the classroom. But I would argue that it's the school district's job to teach and guide these students in having difficult conversations and expressing opinions that might be controversial or political to help prepare them for the real world, especially at the high school level. And that just trying to sanitize and censor students is not an effective means of helping students grow.
Mm-hmm. And so if they came back with a policy that was specific and did kind of apply to different types of viewpoints, would that be enough? Like, I mean, if they came out with a list of, like, here's all the things, and it included all of the groups potentially on campuses, so it would meet that kind of viewpoint neutral test and it would be specific, would that be acceptable?
It depends on how it would be enforced. Right now, the school district has claimed that it is not allowing signs like, for example, the thin blue line sign or display, but we have heard a report that at least one thin blue line poster or display is up in one of the schools. So it has a lot to do with how it's being enforced.
Mm-hmm. And so I understand you have asked for records from the school district to try to understand this. Where does your request stand?
We received a response from the school district that they got it, and they put together a cost estimate, and we're now working on a response to that.
So they intend to comply. We'll pay for the cost of producing the records?
Right. They intend to comply, and in fact, they have to, because we have a law that says this is a public school and their records are subject to investigation. And
right.
So they have to give us the records that we've asked for, and it's just a matter of how much time it will take to get them.
Right. How much is it going to cost?
Well, I don't want to say right now, because they've given us an estimate, but we're trying to negotiate and figure out how we can make it more feasible.
Right, because it could be a lot of records. I mean, I imagine.
It could be a lot of records, and it really depends on how you want to run that type of search as to how much it will cost. And I think there are different ways of going about searching for records, and some can be more cost effective than others. But it does cost money, and a lot of parents and students in the community have submitted open records requests, and what they'll realize right away is that, you know, it's going to cost them money. It's not free.
Right, right. And the search terms, as a journalist, we know, matter,
yes.
Right? What you ask for matters in terms of what you get back and how much you have to sift through. So what's your next step? I mean, have you heard from students and parents here that are also concerned about or potentially interested in taking legal action?
Absolutely. That's how we got involved. We were approached by several community members, parents, people who work for the school, and they have been extremely active and well-organized since this policy was announced in the summer. And they came to the ACLU because they said, hey, we have serious concerns about this policy and how we're hearing it's being expressed. That's when we got involved and started looking into things. They have provided a lot of records to us, which suggests that, you know, this is exactly what's happening, that there's some type of viewpoint discrimination. But again, we need to confirm with the school district. And, you know, our next step would be to try to work with the school district to make sure that whatever policies are fair, don't run afoul of the law, and also protect students. Because one thing that we haven't talked about much is the school district's duty to ensure that this is an environment free from harassment and bullying. And so that not only means that, you know, that they have to restrict specific types of actions that could be harmful, but it may also mean that they have to go the extra mile and take affirmative steps to ensure that this is supportive. And, you know, having a non-discrimination policy that's on display that everybody, all students can understand and see, may be what's necessary for them to feel supported and safe.
We're speaking with Chris Donahoe, staff attorney for the ACLU of Wisconsin. Well, Chris, I imagine a lot of educators could be feeling like they're caught in the middle, right? They want to support their students. They want to make sure that they have a safe classroom. They have an inclusive classroom. They don't support bullying and harassment, and yet they want to comply with their administration's mandates. What advice do you have for them in this moment about approaching this situation?
I agree that teachers are in a somewhat impossible position. They are employees of the school, and of course they need to, you know, ensure that they don't risk their own jobs or livelihood. But they also are there because they care about the well-being of students, and they believe in the free expression of ideas and the students' right to learn and learn about everything, including race and gender, you know, even when that's a difficult topic for some. So, you know, I think that a policy like this puts teachers in such an impossible position because it's so vague, it's so overbroad, and what it ends up having is a chilling effect. It ends up making teachers not want to take any risk because they can't lose their job. They have families to take care of. And so even if something may not be considered political or controversial, if it's somewhat close to something that the school district has named as being banned, they might not want to risk it. And they may just completely suppress any and all type of opinion and discussion and, you know, even personal expression of their own self and lives just to avoid the type of sanction that the kindergarten teacher faced in December.
Right.
And that's not fair to anyone.
So who loses ultimately? What are the consequences if political speech is suppressed at school?
Well, if it's suppressed in this way, the students lose. I mean, one, you have potentially only one viewpoint being expressed, but also the students lose in their ability to learn, and students have a First Amendment right to share ideas and receive information and knowledge. And especially when you're talking about the high school level and upper high school level, if students are not feeling the opportunity to express themselves and to share ideas and to learn how to debate in a civil way with people who have different opinions, then they're really not being prepared for what comes after high school.
Yeah. And so when do you expect to hear back or continue your negotiations with the school district? Like, what do you see as the timeline on this?
Well, again, like you said, it depends largely on how they formulate this search. We hope to get records relatively soon. And then based on the records, we hope to have conversations with the school district to make sure that this is a policy that it's not running afoul of the law. Litigation is always a last resort. Nobody wants this to go to court. And so we hope to just come to the table and make sure that we're all on the same page about what the school district needs and how they can get that within the confines of the law.
I mean, is there the possibility that with this scrutiny that's coming from the open records request that it just kind of leave it alone for a little bit and nothing happens?
Well, what we've seen is that the district has dug in their heels. Ever since the summer when this policy was announced, there has been a lot of media attention on this. The community has been really well organized and active, and the school district has only dug in their heels. So despite months and months and months of protest and pleading from community members, the school district just continued to ramp this up and get more and more and more restrictive. And then we saw in December that one student was suspended without pay. So we don't see the school district backing down from this without some more pressure. And that's disappointing, especially considering the outrage that they've already been facing.
Well, we will continue to follow this issue. Thank you, Chris, for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much.
We've been speaking with Chris Donahoe, staff attorney for the ACLU of Wisconsin. Up next is news. Then we'll have a researcher from Human Rights Watch discussing a wave of accusations that educators are, quote, grooming children. I'm Molly Stentz, and you're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. We're speaking this hour about the culture wars in our public schools and why things have become so contentious. Earlier this year, a school board president in Eau Claire received death threats after its policy of supporting students' sexual identities was widely publicized. He received an email threatening to shoot up the next school board meeting for, and I'm quoting here, promoting the horrific radical transgender agenda. Events like these are happening in school districts across the country, and our next guest has been tracking them. We'd love to hear from you. Has your school district dealt with hostility? Educators, how do you navigate this? We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can always send us an email, ideas@wpr.org. Our guest is Ryan Thorson, a researcher in the LGBT rights program at Human Rights Watch. Ryan, welcome to the morning show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I wonder why we're seeing this uptick, this backlash against school districts' support for their children's identities. Why do you think this is happening?
I think it really traces back to two trends in American politics right now. One is the crackdown on critical race theory in the classroom and this renewed emphasis on parental rights that we've seen in some of the statewide races in Virginia and elsewhere in the last couple of years. That parental rights movement has really gained steam and traction. And I think around COVID and critical race theory, we're seeing a lot more parental engagement with what's being taught in the classroom and the way that school policy is being conducted. But then this has also been a particularly difficult year for LGBT rights in the United States. And, you know, when I started monitoring some of these bills around 2015, we've just seen a steady increase targeting LGBT kids and LGBT issues in schools, where, you know, in 2018, there were about 40 bills nationwide that targeted LGBT people. And this year we had more than 240. And that's, you know, attempting to block trans kids from playing sports, attempting to limit gender affirming care. But a lot of the bills are focused on what is being taught in the classroom and trying to limit any discussion of LGBT identities in public schools. And so I think at the kind of confluence of those two trends, we see attempts to really limit the way that LGBT issues are talked about and to kind of elevate parental rights over the rights of LGBT kids in schools.
And why do you think there is this intense focus on LGBT rights at school?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of reasons. You know, I think with more and more kids identifying as LGBT, I think many parents feel a kind of loss of control or a sense of fear that, you know, their kids are learning things at school that they don't have control over. And that's a fear that's really been fed by a lot of conservative media that I think has become very good at picking out kind of discrete examples from, you know, one school district and one school in the country and making it seem as though, you know, whatever is being taught in that school is nationally representative. And what we know from the research and from the research that I've done in schools across the US is that, you know, teachers are trying to do right by children. They're trying to be LGBT inclusive in the classroom, show that it's a safe space for students. And that includes students who may not have a particularly comfortable home life, or, you know, maybe under real threat of being thrown out of the house, or, you know, facing physical or verbal harassment from parents if they were to come out as LGBT at home. And so, you know, I think in many schools, teachers are trying to do their best, but, you know, when some of that is taken out of context, when it's amplified over social media, when the worst intentions are projected on teachers, it becomes really fertile ground for some really kind of horrific attacks on teachers and LGBT parents.
Well, and some of the accusations being made now are that school administrators and educators are, quote, grooming children. What are they talking about here?
Yeah. So I think it's helpful to kind of clarify what line they're actually pushing. So the term grooming has a very specific meaning in the sexual assault context, and it was coined in the mid-1980s. It means using nonviolent techniques to kind of gain access or trust over control, or control over children, essentially to prepare them to be molested or assaulted. So it's, you know, it's the way that adults kind of ingratiate themselves with children to with the intent of eventually sexually assaulting them. And that term gained popularity in recent political discourse when Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida, his press secretary, accused opponents of legislation that's come to be known as the Don't Say Gay Bill, accused them of being groomers. And then that was immediately amplified on Fox News and other conservative networks, and has become a kind of relentless attack on LGBT-affirming teachers and parents. With the idea that anyone, you know, talking to young people about diverse sexual orientations and gender identities has some kind of ulterior motive in essentially grooming them for sexual activity. But I think that there are two dangers with that. One danger with that is that it cheapens the word, right? Grooming is a real concept in the sexual assault sphere. And if we start calling everything grooming and any conversation about sexuality grooming, it becomes harder for survivors of sexual assault to be taken seriously and have the real incidents of grooming where children are actually being molested addressed and taken seriously. And then on the flip side, I think in schools, these accusations of grooming have a really detrimental effect on kids, parents, and teachers. For teachers, you know, it chills their ability to function effectively in the classroom. It makes them worried about what kind of attacks they'll face if they try to teach inclusive materials. That silence hurts kids because LGBT kids don't see themselves represented in the classroom. It sends a subtle but unmistakable signal that there's something wrong with being LGBT when that topic is off limits in the classroom, but heterosexuality is all around them. And then for LGBT parents, I think it's especially pernicious because we've seen public attacks, including on some parents who are riding an Amtrak train with their kids, with strangers accusing them of being pedophiles because they had kids with them, and because the rhetoric around the country has gotten so hot and so hostile that LGBT people are being seen as pedophiles again. And I think that's a really dangerous kind of reanimation of one of the worst stereotypes about LGBT people, and one that frankly, you know, shouldn't be part of the political discourse in 2022.
We're discussing the rise in accusations of pedophilia in schools with Ryan Thorson. He's a researcher in the LGBT rights program at Human Rights Watch. Well, Ryan, I wonder, I mean, as you mentioned, this phenomenon of grooming is a real thing, and we do know kids can be and are sadly assaulted. There are kids who are sex trafficked. How do parents understand when this is occurring? How do they understand what to look for? So as you say, they can support their children if there is a danger occurring, and distinguish that from, you know, political taunts and accusations that are kind of hurled without base.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I would encourage people to check out the organization RAIN, which provides resources for survivors of sexual assault and has a lot of resources on what grooming actually is. I think there are things to watch out for if, you know, if an adult is giving your child gifts, if there is kind of inappropriate physical touching that, you know, isn't maybe overtly sexual, but is like tickling or touching or things that maybe priming a child for sexual assault. There are things like that that are kind of warning signs for grooming. What I think is being used in this context is classroom instruction, right? That does not amount to those activities. And I think one way that teachers and school boards can, or that school boards and schools can help teachers is to be very clear about the curriculum that they're teaching and not back down from it, right? To say, here are age-appropriate resources that depict diverse families that we think are fine to use in the classroom, and we'll defend teachers that are using these resources. You know, one of the great things about the children's book industry is that there are children's books that deal with a whole range of topics in really age-appropriate ways. And we see more children's books that depict, you know, same-sex parents, that challenge gender norms and show that, you know, boys don't have to like blue and girls don't have to like pink. But even these kinds of books that like depict same-sex families are now being taken off the shelves or
banned,
kind of pulled by school districts that are worried about the accusations that they might face. And I think for school boards to really stand by those materials and be clear about why they're teaching them is really important.
We're speaking this morning with Ryan Thorson, a researcher at the LGBT rights program, Human Rights Watch. We're talking about grooming and accusations of pedophilia, other conflicts in schools. You can always join us, 1-800-642-1234. I'm Molly Stenz, and you're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stenz. We're talking about the culture wars in our schools. Our guest this morning is Ryan Thorson of Human Rights Watch, which tracks discrimination around the country and the world. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. You can always email us ideas@wpr.org. Well, Ryan, I understand you interviewed hundreds of kids in several states a few years ago about the issues that LGBT people are facing in schools. There were laws in place at the time that affected how sexual identity was discussed in schools. What did you learn?
Yeah, so for that project, I had interviewed students in Pennsylvania, South Dakota, Utah, Texas, and Alabama about just kind of a range of things that they were experiencing in school: bullying and discrimination, school shutting down gay straight alliances, curricular restrictions, and discrimination, particularly on the basis of gender identity in schools. But one of the things that we looked at were laws on the books that are often called no promo homo laws, or, you know, no promotion of homosexuality laws, which kind of grew out of the height of the HIV/AIDS crisis, when many schools, when many states were saying that schools should not promote homosexuality in sexuality education. So Alabama, Texas, and Utah all had laws like that on the books when I was conducting the research. And some of them were quite explicit. So Alabama said that schools are supposed to teach students that homosexuality is not a lifestyle acceptable to the general public, and that it's a criminal offense under the laws of the state. And over the last couple of years, those laws have started to be rolled back in states like Alabama and Utah that have taken them off the books. And now with Florida and Alabama, we're now seeing these laws being introduced or reintroduced in a lot of states, limiting discussions of LGBT issues in schools. And the students and teachers that I talked to in the states with these laws on the books talked about the various ways that they kind of chilled any discussion of LGBT issues in the classroom, even when they applied only to sexuality education. The reality is that, you know, teachers were reluctant to assign books in literature classes that featured LGBT characters. They weren't sure if they could speak up when someone used anti-gay slurs in the classroom because they didn't want to be seen as kind of promoting homosexuality. Students would ask questions about LGBT issues in social studies classes and be shut down by teachers. There was just a real uncertainty about what was and wasn't acceptable to teach and what kind of backlash teachers might face from parents if they talked about LGBT issues in a kind of frank and open way with students. And, you know, even in sexuality education, I think that's really dangerous, right? Like, we want LGBT students to have the same kind of information to keep themselves safe and healthy as their heterosexual cisgender peers. But the reality is that these laws just have a chilling effect on the whole school environment and send a really clear signal to LGBT kids that something's wrong with being LGBT.
Right. And so what is the impact on kids when adults in their lives maybe avoid talking about something that they find hard or they find unclear or they don't understand the policy on? What is the impact on the kids?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's two impacts. One is that, you know, students internalize the message that there's something wrong with being LGBT. So when you see, you know, teachers talking about their spouses and assigning books with heterosexual characters, but being LGBT is off limits, it sends the signal that there's still something morally unequivalent about heterosexuality and homosexuality, and that something is wrong with being LGBT. But I think the other piece of it is that it also kind of licenses bad behavior by kids. Like, young people pick up on what they see modeled by adults. And when teachers are treating LGBT issues with kid gloves or treating it as something that's inappropriate for schools, I think young people pick up on that, and it licenses bullying and harassment, which we know is still rampant in US schools. And there's a lot of quantitative data about, you know, showing that LGBT kids are so much more likely to be bullied than heterosexual peers because of their sexual orientation.
Mm-hmm. And so given this, and given, as you mentioned, more than 200 bills across the country on issues like this, how do you kind of assess the state of LGBT rights in America today?
I mean, I think that in general, we see a lot of public opinion polling that shows that, you know, people are much more familiar with LGBT issues. They regard LGBT issues as a matter of basic equality. And things like housing and healthcare and public accommodations, there's enormous support for LGBT inclusive anti-discrimination laws, and for a lot of the issues that are being debated this year. What we don't see is that translating into political leadership. You know, it's something like 80% of the public supports LGBT inclusive non-discrimination legislation. But the way that, you know, states are gerrymandered and state legislatures are set up, we're just not seeing that kind of reflected in legislation. And I think the Don't Say Gay bills are a really good example. You know, we know that these are not hugely popular bills, but the political leadership in certain states have decided that this is a priority and that it is something that kind of ignites their base and excites a particular kind of part of the electorate, and have chosen to push ahead with them, with copycat bills now, you know, passing in Alabama, but being introduced in Ohio and a bunch of other states.
So do you think, though, then if it's the case that the public has evolved and does overwhelmingly support the rights of all people, will these laws have that big of an impact if people agree on equality and don't maybe need a law to tell them how to act?
Yeah, no, I think they still will. And I think part of the reason is that that support for LGBT rights is not equally distributed across the state. So we see these laws already being weaponized in really conservative school districts, or school districts that maybe are just a little bit more careful or reticent about falling afoul of laws like the one in Florida, where we're seeing school districts take LGBT inclusive books and materials off the shelf. And we see teachers who talk about LGBT issues being, you know, kind of featured on conservative Twitter accounts and having their, you know, names and addresses leaked to the public and then experiencing a bunch of harassment. We see teachers kind of quietly being told by school districts that they shouldn't be overt with putting up safe space signs or rainbow flags. And you know, because a lot of support for LGBT rights is concentrated in larger urban areas or suburban areas, I think kids in rural areas in particular are really at risk when these laws pass, because it's not always clear that their school or school district is going to stand up for them and do the right thing And the laws kind of give school districts cover to take away supportive resources, to turn down shows of support that the teachers might otherwise engage in, and to really leave kids who are the most isolated feeling even more isolated than they were already.
And do you, we have a caller that's asking kind of about the political dimensions of this. Linda from Madison called, and she couldn't stay with us, but she wants to know if there have been concerns about kind of grooming and pedophilia at schools coming from left-wing feminist philosophies in addition to right-wing philosophies.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, there's certainly a lot of attention to sexual assault on the left. I mean, absolutely. I think one difference is that, feminist organizations for a long time have emphasized that if you're really concerned about grooming, one of the important things is having comprehensive sexuality education that's age appropriate from a young age to talk to young kids about, maybe body parts when that is appropriate. And then to kind of, gradually, by the time of high school, have kind of comprehensive sexuality education that talks about sexual activity and STIs and consent and things like that. The answer in these situations isn't to withhold information or leave children in the dark, which I think often leaves them more vulnerable. But I think, the left, if I kind of classify that broadly, or feminist groups have emphasized that, teaching kids that they can say no and teaching kids, scientifically accurate, inclusive, age-appropriate sexuality education is one of the best defenses against grooming, because it teaches kids what to watch out for and empowers them to refuse, yes, unwanted touching and things like that.
And Ryan, I want to squeak in one call. We are down to the end of the wire, end of the show here, but Marian Pewaukee, we've got just a few seconds. What's on your mind?
Sure. My comment is that it kind of disgusts me that the conservatives are taking us backwards. So here my thought would be, if you have a child that is a homosexual, or a black child, and you're trying to let them know that this is not right, it is not good, and you're not equal, you're going to have a child or a person grow up to be depressed, suicidal, unbalanced, have all kinds of illnesses based on that fact. So would you rather have a healthy first citizen?
Got it.
Got
it, Mary. Let's we've got just a few seconds left, Ryan, but suicide rates among the LGBT population,
Mary. Yeah, are still high. And one of the things that we know is that having one supportive adult in a child's life makes a world of difference for, mental health concerns and suicide rates. And one of the telling things that I think is very worrying is that the same states that are like rushing to pass these Don't Say Gay bills, or where grooming allegations are really gaining steam, are the same that don't have anti-bullying, yes, protections, anti-discrimination protections, strong, yes, mental health support for LGBT kids.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons why it's so important for teachers to be able to be a resource.
Yes,
for,
Ryan, I'm sorry, we're up against the clock.
I hate
to cut you off, but thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Ryan Thorson, researcher at the LGBT Rights Program, Human Rights Watch. I'm Molly Stentz. It's The Morning Show.